encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Busby Babe podcast. I'm your host, Colin Dams, joined by Just Polly Questel today, who is fresh off of vacation. How are you feeling, Polly?
Back from Europe. I feel great. I feel really recharged. I don't know if you know this. Europe is pretty big in the football. Kind of can't really complain there. Went to a Benfica match. They won in the 100. The wildest ending you'll ever see in your world, in your life. There were 8 minutes of stoppage time. And in the fourth minute of stoppage time, there was a stone cold, clear as can be. We were on the other side. We were behind the other goal. And we saw it clearly, as clear as can be, penalty. And the ref just went up and said, he actually booked him for diving. And said, get up, get on with it. I guess there's no VAR in the Portuguese league, because VAR would have overturned this. And then at some point, like the next 2 minutes, there was a sending off. And a few minutes later, there was a shot that the dude turned and jumped with his back to the ball. It's a tie game, by the way. And it's the most softest, maybe... like, not really, and his arm is, like, pretty much against his body, and he turns his back towards it, and, like, it might hit it grazes his elbow, but it pretty much mostly hits his body, and he gives a penalty for that. And in the 112th minute of 102nd minute of 8 minutes of stoppage time, so the 12th minute of stoppage time, the Benfica's leading goal scorer steps up, scores the penalty, takes his shirt off when he's on a yellow, so promptly gets a second yellow and gets sent off. So Benfica win the match and now have their top scorer suspended for the next match.
Wow. That sounds like Liga NOS.
Yeah. It was incredible.
Well, I'm glad you had a good time. I guess maybe we should watch more Portuguese league. There are quite a few players coming from Portugal, so it would probably be beneficial anyway. But
here's my take on that. It's sort of like the Bundesliga. If it was available in English, more people would watch it.
Good to know. Well, we're glad you're back. And also glad that you got the opportunity to watch Manchester United versus Arsenal. Did you find a good place for that viewing?
Yeah, so I Googled, like, good sports bars in Lisbon, tried to find, like, a United one, but turns out that the number two ranked one in, like, whatever BuzzFeed TripAdvisor article that I read was 70 meters from my apartment. So it was, like, right up the street. It was perfect. They had a TV that goes right outside onto the street, and, like, everybody just... there was like the streets are insanely narrow. I was in the old town. The streets are insanely narrow. So like one car can maybe pass. And then somehow there's a lane where people are able to park. And there was no car in that spot. I don't know if that was intentional or whatever. And like everybody just, there's a line there. So like parking on this side of the line, driving on this side. And so many people were just sat right there just watching the match. There's no open container walls in Lisbon, so like you would go into the bar, get a drink, come outside, and just sit there. It was pretty awesome.
And what was the mix there? I would assume there would be a lot of Manchester United fans given their history of Portuguese players, one in particular, but is that a correct assumption?
There is only one footballer from Portugal. At one point I asked my wife, can she name two Portuguese footballers? And she was like, well, there's Ronaldo, and then struggled to name a second one, you know, despite the fact that, she's kind of pays attention to United. I had a Bruno Fernandes jersey with me. She could not, and I was like, yeah, you would not know it in this country. There is only Ronaldo shirts from all the like touristy shops which sell fake shirts. They only sell Portugal Ronaldo shirts, an occasional, well, there'd be a fake team viewer one from last season, and like one shop had Messi jerseys. And she was like, well, like, why is there Messi? Like, Messi's Argentina. I was like, Messi's Argentina. She's like, well, why is Messi here? I'm like, because you could sell that too. Like, he's the only one. So, it did. I was wearing my United track jacket when I got off the plane, and on our way from the airport to the metro, already one person sued me. But at the bar, it was a very even split of United and Arsenal fans. It was all expats. It was all British.
Yeah. That makes sense. Well, we're going to get into that match a little bit later in the episode. But first, we're going to look at Manchester United starting their Europa League campaign. They'll play tomorrow against Real Sociedad. And we're not going to break down that match specifically a whole lot since it is happening tomorrow. And a lot of you might be listening to this afterward. But we will be discussing... Yeah, the group stage kind of in general and what Manchester
United... Real Sociedad. Here's the gist. It's Real Sociedad. They played them 2 years ago. They won. They should do that again.
Alex Telles was good against this team. So
I think they put four against them. I think they scored four against them.
Yeah, it was like in either leg, they scored multiple goals, I think. Or maybe
I think it was the game where like where Bruno like took that shot off of Dan James's foot and scored.
Yeah. And it was,
either way, like I said, yeah. They won. And
yeah, we should be expecting that again. But so kind of in the lead up to the World Cup, the way that they've crammed all these
games.
Is
home or away?
It is home. So that'll be a boost. But yeah, I mean, we're looking at this group. It doesn't seem very tough. We got Sharif, who... you know, did one over the European champions Real Madrid last season. That was last season, right?
Yeah, FC Sheriff.
Okay, yeah. And we've got Real Sociedad. We've played them before. And then we've got Ammonia, which is a team from Cyprus and not the Chemical. So, yeah. And we, I think the matches against Ammonia are smack dab in the middle. So it goes Sociedad, Sharif, Ammonia, Ammonia, Sharif, Real Sociedad.
And I'm pretty sure if they don't play at home because of the war. So I think those are neutral side games.
Right. There is a war going on. Yeah. So quite the fixture list of European giants here. Do we pretty much assume that Erik ten Hag has to rotate for all these games, considering, you know, how crammed the Premier League schedule is at this moment and how the Europa League fixtures are a part of that?
Yeah, of course he has to rotate. It would be stupid not to. And it's also just, it's the Europa League. And this is what you have a big squad for. And you have to keep your squad happy, which means players that have been on the bench have to come in and play, not just because it's the Europa League, but because, well, what if you need them for... What if someone gets hurt and now you need Fred to be able to play 90 minutes or Casemiro or anybody that's been on the bench? So, but also you can't, you just can't play your whole team in every match. You need to try out new combinations. You need to get guys match fitness. So why not use the Super Cup qualifying campaign as a means to do it?
Right. And I sent this out in a tweet replying to one of our regular listeners, but I think the way that I'm thinking about this is Cristiano Ronaldo should start every Europa League game, even though, you know, in our preseason podcast with Carl, I assumed that that would not be the case. Now that we're kind of further along in this funny interaction between him and Erik ten Hag, and it seems pretty clear that ten Hag just doesn't really value him that much when it comes to the big games. You would expect that, you know, somebody who can just go and get a couple goals against bad teams would be nice to play in all these matches and then rest him in the Premier League.
Yeah, he should start these matches for a couple reasons. One is let's show him everything that UEFA's premier Thursday night competition has to offer. Two, he needs to play. He's going to be annoyed if he's sitting on the bench the entire time. Nope, you get to play in this match. You like playing in Europe. Here you go. And two is, Anthony Martial is hurt. You don't want to run Marcus Rashford into the ground, so you need someone to come in here and eat up minutes. That could be Odion Ighalo. He was a fine Thursday night Champions League.
He scored one of the best Europa League goals ever against LASK.
Right. In this case, it's going to be Cristiano Ronaldo, who Ten Hag has been given cameos now for a few games, and he has done nothing to suggest he is above your Thursday night Champions League level. So he should be able to contribute and help us in our quest to qualify for the Super Cup.
Now, for this game in particular, though, since Casemiro hasn't started a match yet since he's come into the side, do you think that this is potentially one where, you know, maybe just to break him in and get a full match under his belt, this could be a good idea?
Yeah, I expect Casemiro to come into the team. I expect Fred to come into the team. I would expect Anthony Elanga to come into the team. I'd expect Harry Maguire and Victor Lindelof and Luke Shaw to play. Be interesting to see if they bring in Martin Dubravka. I would.
Yeah.
You have to. You can't. Yeah. The thing is, if you do have this plan of we're going to end up using Martin Dubravka, or at least threatening David De Gea by saying we have a guy here that can push you, you can't just be like, De Gea, you're going to play on Thursday and then Sunday against Crystal Palace, or next Thursday and then next Sunday. Like, you have to have Martin Dubravka in there and then eventually be like, hey, he's playing pretty well, even though it's the Europa League. Like, you do remember a few years ago when Sergio Romero had kept 20 clean sheets out of 25 games, and people were like, this guy's amazing, we should be playing him. And it's like, we've had Sergio Romero for 5 years now. Like, he's keeping clean sheets in the Europa League and against lower level teams in England. Like, it's different, but you have to at least be like, hey, you've kept some clean sheets. And more importantly, like, if you're playing him, you're probably playing him because he comes off his line more. You've shown me that in the Europa League. Therefore, we will play you on Sunday.
Yeah. So it would be also kind of, I don't want to say funny,
maybe
because
see if Juan Bissaka plays.
Yeah, I was going to say this back four, if Erik ten Hag runs out the back four that was basically the foundation of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's teams of Luke Shaw, Harry Maguire, Victor Lindelof, and Aaron Wan-Bissaka, I think that potentially says a lot about what he's thought of, you know, the team that was existing coming in. But also, you know, those are players you want to be ready, because if anything happens to the first ones, you know, they're the option. And they're not bad options either. You know,
I think it's story. I think what you're saying is a good story. I
think that's going to be the discourse on Twitter for certain people and groups.
I think right now, as is the case always, and we didn't have this situation this season because the schedule is so weird, the same way that we shouldn't have had it 2 years ago, but we oddly did. But remember, the season usually starts with three games in August, of which maybe, unless there's a new signing or something, there's one change made. Like, you play two different 11s, maybe three different 11s, but a total of 11, 12, maybe 13 players start those games in August. And it's one game a week, so there's no need to rotate the squad, really. And everybody looks at those guys on the bench and go, what are they going to play? And then you go, the manager always has to sit there and go, you got to be patient. You know, we're going to go on an international break. We're going to come back, and it's going to be game, Champions League, game, League Cup, game, Champions League. And we're going to need players, and players are going to get hurt. So in this situation, Ten Hag picked an 11. They won. He went back with the same 11. They won. He's so far just gone with the same 11. So at this point now, it's we have heard people talk about, oh, they're not going to play the way they want to until they get a different goalkeeper. And they didn't spend 60 million pounds on Casemiro to keep him on the bench. So right now you're rotating for the sake of getting players fresh. And then as soon as, and I think Sunday we'll probably see the same 11 against Crystal Palace. And as soon as we drop points, then Ten Hag will, at this point, he's just going with that 11. So once they drop points, he'll be free to make some changes. There might be an injury or something. So I think right now it's about getting players match fit. Lindelof's been hurt. Maguire, Shaw haven't played in almost a month. Fred, Casemiro, others. Donny van de Beek is like injured because of course he is. He's always injured when he's about to play because if he actually plays, he'd reveal that he's not good. The story will be, oh, this is their Europa League squad because they're all shit. When in reality, it's more just we're getting these guys minutes. And once we get deeper into the season and points start getting dropped, we're going to start to see shops and changes and more the team that Ten Hag wants.
I think this might be a good transition into talking about Arsenal because, I mean, us especially have been thinking, you know, eventually Harry Maguire is going to come back in or eventually Casemiro is going to be starting. We just haven't seen that happen yet. It's still very soon after August, obviously. But it seems like Erik ten Hag has, in my opinion, done a good job of kind of feeling out what needs to be done right now. And he's adapted the way that the team is going to play to the strengths of the personnel he has available. And it's worked out really well in terms of, you know, stopping the bleeding, starting to get points on the board. They've won, what, 4 straight now? So, yeah. And also, it's just given us a couple of really nice wins, you know, which are the, right now, they're the bread pieces squishing together the two not-so-nice wins against Southampton and Leicester. But, you know, more on that later, I guess. Because when we play against Crystal Palace, it's not going to be the same sort of setup, I would assume, as it was against Liverpool and Arsenal.
I wouldn't assume that anymore. Like, we said that already. We said we said, you're not going to go and face Southampton with the same team and the same tactics, and that's exactly what they did.
It's not going to be the same result, I guess, is what I meant, because
I'd be very – we'll get to that in a minute. Like, we'll get to that in a minute. Let's talk about Arsenal.
Okay.
Fucking great game. It was a classic Manchester United game of – this wasn't Erik ten Hag ball. This wasn't Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. This wasn't this was the classic bread and butter, especially during the Rooney Ronaldo era, but just Sir Alex Ferguson, what you expect from Manchester United. They sat off of Arsenal a bit. They gave up a little bit early. They maybe should have went down 1-0, but nonetheless, they sat, they weren't panicked, they worked a first goal. They made some very nice plays to work that first goal. And then from there with the 1-0 lead, they were able to sit back and just pick them off on the counter. They went, you wanna, all right, you're down 1-0, come at us. And then Arsenal did. They equalized. And then they went, oh, you're gonna go for a winner? You think we're vulnerable? Come at us. And they picked them off on the counter the way that United used to do it, the way that we've seen them do it so often, and it was so enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, that second goal especially was really a point of kind of realizing all of that was happening in real time, because I mean, a lot of expectations around that sort of strategy where you sit back a little bit is very what comes to people's minds is the kind of negative setup that is associated with like Jose Mourinho. And, you know, as Manchester United fans, we had to watch literally that for 2.5 seasons. But I mean, like you said, this wasn't that. This was different. This wasn't desperation. This was sort of more in control. It definitely didn't seem like United were that uncomfortable, other than I would say coming out of halftime. It just didn't feel like it was a match that they were going to lose, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
No, it didn't. Yeah, I'll agree with that. It's odd because it didn't feel like they were holding on. I thought that it didn't feel like they were holding on because Arsenal were not good.
Right.
There were very vulnerable right from the get-go. It was like 8 minutes into the match. Arsenal had this set piece where they ended up getting a shot from the top of the box. Off a set piece, there's like 9 United defenders in the box, and like from maybe 2 yards beyond the penalty spot, the ball just falls to a wide open Arsenal player. And it's like, how did he get that open? And there were several times where Arsenal got the ball into the box into a wide open player.
Martin Ødegaard should have made it. I think it would have been the equalizer at the time, but it was like a minute before Bukayo Saka scored, where Ødegaard just totally missed on a chance that would have been a sure thing goal.
Yeah. So like one of the things that this United team do is defend their box really well. And that's why everybody's loving Varane, Lisandro Martinez right now, because that when it comes to last ditch defending, they are superb. They are excellent. Arsenal successfully entered United's box 27 times. That's the most anyone's done it this season. That beats Southampton, which also beats Liverpool. It was also United's they played with the lowest line they've played all season, which Liverpool was a low line. This one, even lower. And part of that's game state of we have the lead, we could sit back and pick you off now. But it was happening. They didn't feel, like you said, they didn't feel under siege.
So I want to talk a little bit about Marcus Rashford, because obviously what we saw from him in this game and the Liverpool game is nothing out of the ordinary when you come to what you come to expect from, you know, Marcus Rashford in good form. He'll make the key run for a line breaking pass. He'll beat the keeper one on one. He's fit for these counterattacking situations. But what does it say about it that, you know, coming off of last season, Marcus Rashford is able to kind of adapt to this weird sort of central role playing for Erik ten Hag, not being the sort of, you know, pressing forward that a lot of people expected United would want to play, but still playing a good role in a team that is, you know, finding its feet?
Well, they're not pressing from the front. So that's helped him immensely. Mm-hmm. Rashford doesn't work that hard. That was always kind of the issue with was that Rashford doesn't work very hard. Mason Greenwood didn't work very hard. And when Ralph Ragnick wanted to came in, it was all the focus was on Cristiano Ronaldo, but it was like, you're not going to be able to do this with Rashford or Greenwood either. And that was part of the issue that United had last year, was there was so much focus on it that it was almost like Ronaldo being like, watch how high I'm going to go and we're going to push up high. But then like you pushed up high with Rashford and Mason Greenwood out there not working hard either. And it wasn't just one, like we say, like you could do this with Ronaldo if you have the other 10 guys working hard to make up for it. But like you had another guy, not just like working hard, just not doing anything. So now it's, you have 9 guys trying to make up for 2. It's never going to work. So Ten Hag they're not pressing all that much. They are dropping back and they're letting you. And there's nothing wrong with that. That doesn't necessarily mean you're Jose Mourinho-ing parking the bus either. United let teams get to the halfway line where then they go with what I call the half court trap of, now that there is space, now we're going to start pressing. So we don't need to press your center backs at the top of the box. We don't need to press your goalkeeper. We're fine to press your guys once you get your defensive line up to the halfway point. That's where we want to press you, because that's where now there's space for Rashford to run in behind. So Rashford struggled last year because United didn't play any counterattacks. They didn't look for Rashford running in behind. Everything was slow and methodical and building up and playing more in a half-court offense rather than run on the fast break. And as soon as Ten Hag came in and said, we're going to do that again, Rashford thrived. And now the question becomes, will Marcus Rashford be able to do that against other teams. They had
Crystal Palace.
Right. They had much more of the ball against Southampton and against Leicester. And Rashford was much quieter. He had the assist, which again came from a similar situation. He had the assist against Leicester, similar situation, off the throw and bad play, taking advantage of the fact that Leicester took their best center midfielder, put him in that center back where he is not a center back, and mistakes were made. Rashford made a great play. There were breakdowns that led to that. But the rest of the game, there wasn't much. And that's going to be the question mark going forward, is we know Rashford can do this against Liverpool and against Arsenal and against any team that wants to come and take the game to United because they feel like they're better. We've talked about this before. Marcus Rashford, Jamie Vardy have phenomenal records against the top teams because their best attribute is the ability to run in behind, and those are the games where you get the most space to run in behind.
I think it's going to be interesting, too, now that Antony is part of the equation, because obviously it's a fit for what Ten Hag wants from his wingers. He stays pretty high and wide. He's good at getting into the goal area when he needs to. When United are in these games where they're going to be holding the majority of possession, you'd expect, you know, Sancho out left, Antony out right, having the same sort of, you know, relationship with the fullbacks as, you know, Antony did with Nusair Mazraoui when he was at Ajax, maybe allow Diogo Dalot into some of those winger spaces when they're in possession. What is the deal with the work rate when it comes to Antony as opposed to some of United's other wingers? Because we've seen from Jadon Sancho and Marcus Rashford, they're not necessarily those like high pressing types who will come back and do defensive work. Do we think that Antony is, or do we know if Antony is too?
Sancho is too. He's not Mo Salah, Sadio Mane out there, but he does a good amount of work. Antony will do work. And Antony will get up and down the pitch. And he adds that creativeness. We did see that he likes to cut inside on his left foot and have a go. But he does. I mean, I haven't watched much of him, so this is the Suede scouting report of he does much more creative things besides just doing that United have lacked from a left-footed player. And then when it comes to that, it's going to be a situation of, for Rashford, are you going to make those runs? Are you going to get into those goal scoring areas? Like his assist to Antony was probably the first time we've seen him play like Anthony Martial. When Martial got hurt in 1920, Rashford stepped into that role and he was awful. And this was like a Martial assist of like he got the ball, he timed it right, he made the little dink off. He played more with his back to goal, which we rarely ever see because it's not his game. And he's sort of added that, which is good. But then it's like when you're not if you're gonna be your back to goal striker and you help move the ball up the pitch. Now, once Antony has it in the final third, crashing into the box, it's can you make those runs? Can you get into the good goal-scoring areas so you can get that goal off of a set against the set defense?
Right. I think that's going to have to be the major adjustment for him if he's going to, one, keep up this form, but also keep his spot as, you know, one of the rotation under Erik ten Hag. Because, you know, we've seen a lot of times when United have to break down teams, Rashford on the wing is not going to always offer you that ability. So if he can figure out a way to do it centrally, great. I mean, I would obviously love for that to happen. I'm loving this sort of mini resurgence he's having. It's really good just seeing him scoring and having fun for United again. But to make something sustainable out of this is
it's everybody's. Yeah. Everybody's reacting to it as if like he's back, and it's just wait. He has 3 goals this year, and all 3 of them are he ran in behind. And it's like, show me something different. It's very nice that you are back on form. That United are back on form, because last year they played these teams and they couldn't sit back and counter. They were incapable of it. They didn't have the players. They didn't have the right personnel. combinations out there to do it. I mean, like putting Ronaldo out there against City and against Liverpool, never going to work. The team they put out there against Chelsea when they actually got a 1-1, you know, they got a gift of a goal in that match. And then on the back half of the season, those games against City and Liverpool again, like they were just it, Ralf Rangnick could not coach counterattacking. And now that it's back in there, it's great to see Rashford doing it again, because this is what he does. You know, it's like going into a pizza shop and seeing the chef make a pizza. Like, that is what you do. But the question is, are you like you? It's a bad analogy, because whatever.
Well, it's like, hey, can you have any other pizzas? You have any specials of the week, or is it? Are you just, do you only make pepperoni?
Right. Or yeah. Or could you, you know, become? Could you round out your menu to be like a full Italian place?
Yeah. Like, can we get some pasta or something?
Pasta.
Yeah. I think Casey would be proud of our work to make that metaphor.
Yeah. Get some soup.
Yeah. All right. So
there is
one more thing. Like, okay, you go first.
What were you going to say? Is it about Arsenal?
Yeah. I was going to bring up Christian Eriksen.
Oh, okay.
Because this seems like another one of those situations. I mean, obviously different to Marcus Rashford in terms of, you know, what we know he can offer the team as a player, because Christian Eriksen coming in and being this vital seems like, you know, he has that in his locker.
It's problematic.
But also, how long can we do this?
This is what I said to when I spoke to Suede in like July, and I was like, Christian Eriksen, as a cherry on top, is a great signing. Brings you good, like, Christian Eriksen had to be Juan Mata. And you can play him in a different position, but that's where his role in the squad had to be. Mm-hmm. You lost Paul Pogba, you lost Nemanja Matic. You lost Juan Mata. You needed to replace Matic, Pogba, Mata. I mean, you could argue that you didn't need to replace Mata, but, like, if you did, that's a good thing. And that's where Eriksen had to be. And Eriksen, as the free transfer on the as the cherry on top, is a great signing. What I said was, we got him early, and before you know it, United are going to be like, no, we signed Christian Eriksen. That's one of our signings. And I said to Suede, my fear is, you know, he comes in August, plays really well, makes himself undroppable, and suddenly now, instead of being a rotation guy, he's playing every single match in August. Then he goes to the World Cup, where he is Denmark's most vital player, and he's playing every minute of that match, of those matches. And suddenly you look around in January, and it's like Christian Eriksen hasn't done anything in 8 matches, and United are drawing games, or he's just picking up little knocks, and he's wearing down. He looks knackered already, and it's a Paul Pogba situation. He ended up replacing Paul Pogba. He's the glue of the team going to function without him, which makes him vital. And if he gets hurt, you're going to be looking at a situation where the team wins a lot less games.
Yeah, this is a big reason why I think we need to start breaking in Casemiro, Fred, Pivot as soon as possible. Because one, we got to figure out what it looks like and what that's going to offer the team. And two, you just can't rely on Christian Eriksen to play every match this season. I mean, he's a 30-year-old with a heart condition.
Well, like, I don't even know what the Casemiro Fred pivot does for you, because it still lacks the thing that Christian Eriksen gives you that we know that Fred doesn't have. We know that Scott McTominay doesn't have. We know that Fred and Matic, when they played together, was our best defensive pair, because you had a guy who would push up, get involved, break up counterattacks, be a whole nuisance, win the ball back. And if you got past him, Matic would step in and just delay you enough that Fred could get back into position. And Fred and McTominay don't work, because Fred does all that, but McTominay's not in position. If you get past Fred, McTominay goes, oh, I'm going to go win the ball back. And then he tries to engage you rather than keep you in front of him and delay you. And that's sort of what the Casemiro and Fred thing is. They played very well together for Brazil, but Brazil isn't a possession-heavy team. It's international football. We know there's more time and space on the ball in the international game. It is CONMEBOL, which is a whole different ballgame. Teams know, like, oh, if Fred's going to be the guy passing, because Casemiro has not looked really good on the ball so far.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't going to bring it up just because I'm kind of tired of talking about it, but that giveaway that he had in possession where Harry Maguire took the yellow card rather than letting up a goal-scoring opportunity, I mean, that didn't look great.
It looked bad.
It's better for Casemiro that he had Harry Maguire to be the scapegoat in that situation.
Oh, for sure. For sure. That's exactly. And he did the same thing against Leicester. He did something similar against Leicester where he came on like immediately bad giveaway. Against Southampton, he missed a couple challenges. But I remember watching that and being like, oh, Maguire's going to take the heat for that, but Casemiro, that's a bad giveaway. And then I was just actually watching it to pull the GIF like an hour ago, and I didn't realize how bad it was in that he actually scans, looks around. When Christian Eriksen's about to play him this pass, he looks around. He sees he is in acres of space. So he should see that there is no one near him and see that all the players are to my left, but I've got lots of room to my right. And when that ball comes, you have to let it run across you. And even if you don't, if you let it run across you, it brings you to the middle of the pitch where you have time, space, options. And even if you don't handle it cleanly, you can just put your boot through it and send it out wide to Delote because there's no one in that blocking that pass. Or if there is and you're worried, who is the right wing at that point was like Bruno. Bruno's in acres of space. All you got to do is like chip one in that area, chip one over the top to Bruno. And even if, you know, or worst comes to worst, you miss hit it and it goes out. But instead he cuts his body off and takes a very hard touch, which he struggles to settle. But by doing that, he brings a defender to him. He cuts off the back pass to Eriksen and he cuts off a pass to Fred. He's got nowhere to go now. Because of poor body positioning. And then on top of that, takes a heavy and a bad touch, and it quickly goes the other way, and Maguire ends up being the scapegoat. But, oh, it was bad.
Well, hopefully that is not a recurring trend, but,
It makes me worried about the midfield. Still, and it makes me worried about the long-term viability of this team because you've now turned Christian Eriksen into Paul Pogba. And
right. It's like what happens when they do what they used to do to Paul Pogba, where it's like, okay, we'll trigger the press on him and just let McTominay have the ball. Or how do you keep putting Christian Eriksen in these positions without, you know, wearing him out as well?
So the thing is that it's not going to be the same like that because the midfield setup is different. And that's a Ten Hag thing of the system is different of like, you're not, although granted, you know, it wasn't like Pogba and Nemanja Matic were ever next to each other. Matic always moved, created angles. And then when McTominay came in and Fred would do the same thing. And then when McTominay came in, he was always just like next to you. But now they've at least gotten McTominay not next to you. He's never really open or useful. And like, they still do not pass to him at a comical rate. But at least he's not in a spot where you all of a sudden go, we're going to force the ball to Scott McTominay. What happens when they do sit on Christian Eriksen? I don't know. You tell me, did you watch the Brentford match? Cause that's what they did.
And also, Eriksen had to be the deep midfielder that day.
On him.
So
here's what I find funny is, and not funny, annoying, almost aggravating, is the discourse around this club now has become sort of like American politics post-Trump, maybe even Obama, in that it feels like back then there was, you know, I'm on this side, but I can acknowledge that some of my side is I don't agree with, and that some of your side I agree with, but I like this guy because those are the more important things.
Oh, are you talking about like factions of United Twitter?
Just everything. it's now getting to the point where, like, Christian Eriksen has a few good games. They're trying to erase Paul Pogba from history. And it's like, Paul Pogba was pretty good. He had his flaws. Pretty freaking good. There's a reason United won a hell of a lot more when he played than when he didn't. People are so...
People want to be right more than...
It's not even that they want to be right. They're getting... what's the word? I'm completely blanking on the word. They're getting annoyed. It's not annoyed. It's defensive, annoyed when people say that they played on the counterattack. They're getting insulted when people say they played on the counterattack in this match. And it's like, they did. And that's fine. That's okay. But people are annoyed about it. And it's the Ten Hag supporters. Because they're like, well, look at the first goal. That wasn't a counterattack. And it was like, okay, it wasn't, but they still were sitting back. Like, we've played with a lower line, which is not what... You didn't hire Erik ten Hag to come in here and play with a line this low. And as everybody tries to be like, oh, he's making compromises, but you could see his principles. And people being like, oh, well, that three-minute stretch was the best stretch United have played in possession. I can't even remember how long. It's like, nothing happened in those 3 minutes. They made a couple of good passes, and there are some good things happening. You don't have to oversell it, and people are getting so insulted by the notion that they played on the counter, and it's like, they did, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong playing on the counter. The reason you're upset is because you spent 2 years being like, counterattacking football is dumb and bad, because you didn't like the fact that that manager was playing and winning on the counter, and that manager was doing it because that's what he realized was the best way to win games with this team. And now a new manager comes in and is not playing at all. There's a few things that are recognizable from his Ajax team, but for the most part, he's sacrificed a lot of his principles to be like, how do I get results? My defense is just going to freaking kick it away. We're just going to hoof it long, try to get it back. We're going to play on the counter, and it's working. And you're trying to, like, bend it to be like, no, 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 that's not what it is. And it's like, that is what it is. I'm like, you're only mad because you spent 2 years being like, counterattacking football is bad. And it's really just, you didn't like that guy. And that's what worries me now against Crystal Palace, because they played two games where United were bad. And I'm not going to say lucky to win against Leicester and Southampton. I'm going to say they were a bit lucky to win both. The numbers were not in favor of them. Southampton and Leicester are bad, bad teams. And a better team than Leicester makes United pay for the way that they played against them.
And Crystal Palace are a better
and
team.
And Crystal Palace is a better team. And if you go out there and put out these two performances, and fraud, maybe Crystal Palace tries to take the game to you and actually plays into your hands. And it's like when... When United had just lost to Istanbul Başakşehir and needed to right the ship, and they had that match against Everton, and Everton were actually playing well at the time, and they didn't come out.
Yeah, Carlo Ancelotti's Everton, right?
Yeah. They didn't come out like swarming United, but they also didn't sit back. They kind of just played like, we'll go back and forth with you. And it was like, all right, but like, now you're leaving yourselves open, and like, you're playing in the United's hands, and this is actually working really well for United, but you're also not challenging them. Crystal Palace may do that, in which case this team should have no problems. But if United are going to play like they did against Leicester or Southampton, and Crystal Palace play in a similar manner to those two, they're better, and they're going to hurt United. And that's exactly the issues that the old United had 2-3 years ago.
I think my problem with this is that, like, it's almost not giving Erik ten Hag the credit he maybe deserves for, and look, this is me doubling down on my glory road, you play your way, but you also play my way thing. But, you know, maybe it's a good quality in a manager that he looks at the squad he has and accepts its strengths and weaknesses and tries to, you know, play the best way to those abilities rather than doing what Ralph Rangnick did and not doing those things.
It's that there was a part of the fan base, because the old manager did that, that was just like that. Remember, there were people in our comment section that would be like, well, he talks about playing front foot football and he's not doing that. So like, what? This is no different than Mourinho. And it's like he's, and he also said layer by layer, we're trying to build and we're trying to get there. But he recognized this is what I have to do right now. And the downside to that is, I wrote about this over the summer, is as you do that, certain players don't develop the habits that you need them to develop. Scott McTominay just never developed on the ball. He was really good in the games like against Arsenal and against Liverpool, where you strip away his responsibilities and you say, we just need you to be a menace. And when you get the ball, just get rid of it. When we need a midfielder to be on the ball, he has not developed that. Marcus Rashford, we doubled down on running behind. And we never really developed the, oh, that team's sitting back. We need you to now be more creative, work on that decision making. So, and the more Ten Hag does that, the more your players don't develop those habits. They don't develop those skills because you're just sitting back on, well, my team has holes. This is the best way to get results. And we saw what happened is Solskjaer got results by doing that. And all while he did that, there were just people yelling, people in his face, people trying to knock him back for everything. And this isn't me saying that he's an unbelievable manager. I've never said that. It was just he's getting the job done. You're making it out to be like he's way worse than he's actually doing. And now we're like over. And now you get the people that were fans of him going, being like, how's this any different than Solskjaer? And there are differences. I'm not saying that there aren't. But then you get the other side just being like, oh my God, this is so different. And like Ten Hag's great. And it's great to see him compromising on it. It's just like, it's just, we have lost the point where we could be like,
there are factions when there don't have to be.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm hoping that at least, you know, the positive vibes keeping up with Manchester United will deter any sort of, you know, gestures that last season. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what, if success does come this way, what sort of discourse happens from that.
Don't forget, these are the same players, and the guy who is wearing the armband currently and being great and embodying Manchester United, these are, other than Antony and Eriksen, the same players that didn't deserve to wear the shirt and had no interest in playing last year.
Right.
Apparently, and it had nothing to do with the fact that like they were just being put in a situation where their skills don't work, you know, like these are other than Harry Maguire, these are the same guys that lost 4-0 to Brentford, and it had nothing to do, it's because they didn't want it enough and now they want it and now they're all happy to play for United. It had nothing to do with the fact that Brentford had a better game plan and we didn't put our players in a position to succeed.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really know what to add to that. I guess I'll just finish the podcast. thanks for listening. So tomorrow I'll try and be back with Nathan to recap the Real Sociedad game. Polly may or may not be on that one. Just had to.
Thursday night Champions League.
Right. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.